Energy and Environment Committee, and welcome. It's Monday, what is today, the 12th of March, and we are going to open up a work session on House Bill 2294, the fish screening bill. Kat, can you give us an overview of where we are and what amendments we have in front of us, please?
We looked at LC-1 amendment last week, and today we're going to see, you have in front of you LC-2, which incorporates the -1 amendment. And I'm going to let somebody, Roy Elliker, probably go through that new amendment for you.
Okay, Roy, can you come up, please? So you should have the -2 amendments in front of you. Does everyone have that at their dais? Roy, if you can walk us through, and if you remember, we were pretty close, and I think you and Representative Burley and Mr. Kosasan went out in the hall and figured things out.
For the record, my name is Roy Elliker, Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, here on the -2 amendments on House Bill 2294, and thanks to the good auspices of Representative Burley, the Vice Chair, who took us out in the hallway. Mr. Kosasan and I and Representative Burley came to an agreement on the final tweak here of this amendment, and essentially the -1s and -2 are exactly the same, with the exception that on page 3, line 7, the word minor is restored to the act, and then on line 8, the bracketed material is restored, and instead of $25, the amount will be $150. And that is essentially the difference between the -1, -2, and as agreed upon through Representative Burley's help.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions for Roy? I want to thank Vice Chair Burley for helping smooth the path on this one.
Thank you, Representative.
Appreciate it very much. Is Richard here? You want to come up and say anything? Okay. Shaking his head for all of you in the front there. Well, I appreciate both of you working together on this. I much prefer to have a bill that with amendments and agreements. So with that, I will look for a motion to pass the -2s.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the LC-2 amendments to House Bill 2294.
Representative Cannon moves the -2 amendments to House Bill 2294. Is there any discussion? Okay. Is there any objection? Okay, no objection. The motion carries.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2294 as amended by the -2s to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Revenue Committee by prior reference.
Representative Cannon moves House Bill 2294 as amended with the -2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill will be referred to the Revenue Committee by prior reference. Are there any questions or any discussion? Okay. With that, will the clerk call the roll, please? Excused.
Representative Flyer?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Let me think about this.
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Dingfeld?
Aye. Motion having received the required majority is declared passed. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2294, and thanks the department and Representative Burley and Water for Life for working together on that. Next, I'm going to open up an informational session on groundwater management in Oregon, and we have a lot of really excellent people who are coming to talk to us today about groundwater management. We had a very interesting discussion in the House, in the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources today on this very topic. So Representative Burley and I are already warmed up on that issue. So we wanted to first ask Debbie Colbert from the Water Resources Department to come up, and she's going to give a brief overview for us. And we are hoping to get through everybody today. We do have some people that came from a little bit further away, so I'm going to ask them to come up first. But we do have a little time on Wednesday's agenda as well. We have asked the DEQ to come on Wednesday and talk about groundwater quality, because that's one part that we didn't have covered today. And then also, as many folks know, I've already talked to, I think, most people in this room about this, we will have a work group on groundwater management, and we will talk a little bit about that towards the end of today's committee meeting. Thank you. Madam Chair, if I could start by just handing out some follow-up material that you requested for the committee related to some of the background information in our budget. Thank you. And I also wanted to welcome Representative Clem, who's down there at the end of the dais, and I invited him to join us today. He serves on the Land Use Fairness Committee along with Representative McPherson and was thrilled to hear that we were going to be talking about groundwater today. So I am really pleased to have him up here with us. Welcome. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have here with me today Doug Woodcock, who's actually the manager of our groundwater program at the Water Resources Department. So we're going to be tag teaming on an overview of some of our existing statutory tools for both permitting new groundwater uses and also managing resource areas that we have concern. This is a slide that you've seen before in the 101 that Director Ward and I gave. This just shows the density of wells across Oregon. And just wanted to set the stage by reminding the committee that we have a 1955 water code that was adopted. We have about over 10,000 permitted groundwater uses across the state. We have about just over 200,000 exempt domestic wells across the state. And about 4,000 groundwater registrations. These are uses of water, groundwater, that predate the 1955 water code and have not been adjudicated yet. So just to set the stage on in terms of the density of wells across the state and basically what we're already managing in terms of permitted and domestic wells.
Debbie, can you just quickly, I thought they would be on this handout, but can you just go through those numbers really quickly again?
Absolutely. Again, just overall, we have just over 10,000 permitted groundwater rights. We have about 225,000 domestic wells. So these are wells that were not issued through a formal water right permitting process. We'll talk a little bit more about those authorities in this presentation. And then we have about 4,000 groundwater registrations, and these are uses that predate the 1955 water code and have not been adjudicated.
Thank you.
Generally, to establish a new groundwater use in Oregon, one must apply to WRD for a groundwater permit. We have a number of categories that we look to when we're evaluating these groundwater permits. First of all, it must be compatible with the basin plan. The basin plan is just the rules adopted by the commission that establishes the allowable uses in that basin.
Excuse me, could you state your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I'm Doug Woodcock. That's Doug Woodcock with Oregon Water Resources Department. I manage the groundwater hydrology section.
Thank you, Doug.
And thank you for this opportunity today. So first of all, we look to the basin program and make sure that the proposed use is compatible with the basin program. And the basin program is just the rules that are adopted by the commission that outlines which uses are allowable. We look to make sure that there's no injury to existing users. We don't want to issue new water rights that would preclude existing users from getting their allowable quantity of water. We look to water availability. We take a look at the groundwater data, the hydrology data, to make sure that the resource can sustain the new use. And we look to make sure that the new use is consistent with other commission rules. For example, our Division 9 rules. We evaluate all groundwater applications for hydraulic connection and potential for substantial interference in the state of Oregon, and that is interference with surface water flows. However, there are some uses that are statutorily exempt from having to file for a groundwater permit, and we refer to these as exempt uses. This is a list of a few of the more common exempt uses. For example, single and group domestic, household washing, things like that, up to 15,000 gallons per day. Commercial and industrial uses, 5,000 gallons per day. Non-commercial lawn and garden, up to 1/2 acre of irrigation. Now, while these are exempt from filing on a permit or for a permit, they are still considered a water right and they have a priority date.
I'm going to interrupt you right there because the question I have is, if they don't have to register, then is the priority date the date that they put in a start card to have their well drilled? I mean, how do you
The priority date is the well construction date on the off of the well report.
Maybe, Madam Chair, if it's okay, maybe Doug could just highlight that start of construction submittal quickly.
Sure.
So right here, all wells, exempt uses or permitted users, the uses are subject to regulation by priority date. And so at the time that a well is drilled, they are required to submit a start card, which is the notification of construction, and then also submittal of a well report that identifies how the well was constructed, the water it picked up, the materials it encountered, and also includes that well construction date. Of the exempt uses, domestic uses are the greatest number. Here we have a map, and this is also included in your handout here. We estimate that about 3,800 domestic uses or domestic wells are drilled each year. And this shows the statewide totals for the last 3 years. 3,700, 4,000, 3,700, 85. By far, the most active basins in the state are the Willamette Basin, the Rogue Basin, and the Deschutes Basin. So where we have groundwater concerns in the state, the Commission has a number of tools available to them to address those issues. So here are a few of them. Classifications. So this is where the Commission, by rule, goes into a basin plan and adopts rules that defines what uses are allowable in that basin. So a restrictive classification essentially could prevent any new development. Here in the groundwater, or here in the Willamette Basin, these restrictive classifications are often considered or called groundwater limited areas. Withdrawals. The Commission can, by order, withdraw all unappropriated waters in a basin or a defined area. And that can, you can, that order can be restrictive to particular uses or can eliminate all uses. An example of that, well, I'll look at some examples in just a moment, but not long ago we did a withdrawal up in the Victor Point area near Silverton. Now these first two items, withdrawals and classifications, are reactive, but they are not retroactive, and by that I mean that when we begin to see that there is a problem, then we can move to stop continued development or restrict continued development, but it doesn't go back and affect existing users. So if a particular use were to be eliminated from allowable uses in a basin, it doesn't go back and prevent those people with water rights for those uses from exercising their rights. So those first two, withdrawals and classifications, prevent a problem from getting worse.
So just to clarify, that's only for future
uses. For future uses, that's correct.
Okay.
The next item here, the critical groundwater area designations, that's really the jackhammer in the tool belt. This is where it's a two-step process, first by rule to define an area boundary, and then secondly, through contested case hearing to define how much water can be allocated within that boundary. So this actually goes back and tries to correct a problem. While there may be, say, 10,000 acre feet of water on paper in a critical groundwater area, critical groundwater area designation through this allocation process can restrict that back to whatever the sustained annual yield is determined to be through the contested case process. So it may be 1,000 acre feet, for instance. So it's very intensive process. Both
yes.
An intensive process, both administratively, and it's very hard economically on the local, out in the local areas where these critical groundwater areas are established.
Can you tell us also how many of both the groundwater limited areas we currently have and how many critical groundwater area designations?
Oh,
there you go.
I can do better. I can show you a picture.
Good.
So here we have a map. This is also in your handout. That shows where we have these groundwater restricted areas across the state. In the sort of yellowish tone here, we have the classified areas. We have 14 of those around the state. Ella Butte, we have Fort Rock, and then we have about a dozen of them here in the Willamette Basin. And those areas are just, in the Willamette Basin, for instance, they're just largely, you know, with some exception, focused on a particular rock type, a Columbia River basalt aquifer, and they just restrict back the irrigation uses, or, excuse me, rephrase, they restrict uses back to exempt uses only. So all of the other permitted uses are either prohibited or on a time-dated, like a five-year permit allowance.
So the exempt, for instance, exempt wells are allowed in all of those, even in a restricted area.
That is correct. In these classified area, the groundwater limited areas, exempt uses are allowed at this time. In the darker rust color, we have our critical groundwater areas. And we have four of those in Representative Jensen's area out here in Umatilla Basin. We have one in Cow Valley on the east side, and we have one up here in the Dalles area. Those also, and we have one more up in the Cooper Bull Mountain critical groundwater area. Those areas also allow exempt uses to continue. The Cooper Bull Mountain has some restrictions on how the exempt uses are applied.
Very quickly, Madam Chair. Yes.
Yeah, Representative Smith.
Just a comment for the committee and the folks who are in the room today. On that critical groundwater area, that's a very real issue for industrial development as well in the area. And ironically, it was this body that passed legislation that's going to allow additional biofuel facilities to be placed in that area. And so I raise that correlation for you to keep in the back of your mind when you hear folks going through the building talking about the need for additional water. That red right up there in that corner is where those biofuel facilities are being placed. And they're huge, huge consumers of H2O. Thank you.
Lastly, I would point out the two withdrawal areas that we have in the state. We have one right up here in the Mosier area, where two aquifers are withdrawn from any further appropriation. Exempt uses are allowed in that withdrawal area. And then in the Victor Point area right here near Silverton, it is fully withdrawn. No exempt uses are allowed in that withdrawal area. So in summary on this map, I would just point out that these are very data-intensive and science-intensive restriction areas. We don't go into these areas lightly. We collect a lot of information, and we present this information to our commission because they are restrictive to the people that want to develop their property. And so it takes a lot of effort and a lot of analysis to put these restricted areas together for adoption. With that, I would open it for some questions.
Madam Chair, that was the kind of the highlights that we were going to cover today for the committee, and unless you have any further questions for us.
I'll see if the panel has any questions. Representative Cannon?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. You talked about the importance of data gathering in order to make these kinds of determinations, and I'm just still trying to get my head around how this all works. We're talking about thousands of wells that are not required to undergo a permitting process, and about which presumably you don't have a lot of data on how much water they're extracting. You trust, I suppose, that they're under the 15,000 that's required in order for them to be exempt. But could you talk about how you know what's happening in any part of the state where there is a high concentration of exempt uses?
I'll take this from a couple of angles. The first being that we do cooperative groundwater investigations across the state because the data collection is very, very, very important. And so, first of all, in our cooperative study, cooperative program that we have with the U.S. Geological Survey, we will pick a basin and we do data collection networks across that particular basin. So, for instance, we've done several of these studies to date. We've done one in the Deschutes Basin, which is in this area right here. We're in the process of working on one in the Klamath Basin down here. We have one in the Willamette Basin that we're just completing as well. And we look at a basin-wide data collection effort for starters. And we set up a well net We collect data on those. We build a geologic framework. We get an understanding of how groundwater moves through the system, how it recharges, where it discharges. We work with other agencies where we can to look at the water quality issues. And the concept is you come up with a water budget for that area. And the project can be divided into sub-areas as well where it makes sense to do so. And so we look at the existing water uses that are out there. We estimate what the exempt uses are. You're absolutely right. We do not have meters on those exempt uses. So we have to estimate what it is those uses are, what those uses are. In a broad sense, I think we can do a pretty good job of that. We also rely on the data that we receive from the existing users that are out there, all of our permitted uses that are required to submit water level and water use data. And we take that information along with our analytical tools, and we fit those into our water budget. So that's at the very broad scale of coming up with a budget. Focusing in, we also have well nets around the state of Oregon that help us understand what the water level resource is doing in any small area. Now, we don't have we're not covered by every square mile, but we do have a fair network out there, and we rely on that information that our people collect and our water masters and our cooperating local agencies, the local governments that help us with those data collections, to look at that information to see if the resource is stable and whether it can sustain new uses.
That's a follow-up question of a sort. Maybe it's a little bit different, but what kind of recourse does a well user have when, because of, say, other pressures on groundwater, namely the development of other wells in the area, their well is dry?
Madam Chair, Representative, as pointed out in the slide presentation, all wells are subject to regulation by the prior appropriation doctrine. And so as a user, and that includes an exempt user, runs out of water because of other pressures, they can make a call to the water master for regulatory relief. So that would involve going out, doing an investigation, determining the cause of that interference and that water supply problem, and regulating appropriately.
Follow-up, Representative Pearson and Representative Cannon.
Yeah, in fact, it is a follow-up on Representative Cannon's question. So a prior user has a residential well, and it runs dry, and it's determined that it's because there are several other wells that have been put into in the same aquifer in the same area. What remedy then occurs? Is that prior user able to force discontinuation of the neighboring wells that caused the problem?
Well, that is the doctrine of prior appropriation. There is a priority date associated with that right. Now, when, with your example, the residential user runs out of water, they will contact the water master. The water master will do an evaluation, get all of the important pieces of information together. Then he'll contact the groundwater section, which is my group of people, and we'll go out and we'll take a look and do an analysis to determine whether, in fact, the person that's running out of water is actually running out of water. And there are many occurrences where it's not just that they've run out of water, it's a well problem. And this is an important distinction to make, because there are wells going in, and people are nervous about their water supply when they see other wells being drilled. But what we will do is we'll go out and, or perhaps they'll hire a well driller to do the same thing, but do a test on that well to determine whether it is actually out of water or whether it's just the well has deteriorated over the years to the point where it doesn't allow water to get into the borehole anymore. And that's a very simple test to determine that. Now, if they are in fact out of water, if they have a good viable supply there, then we'll step out and start looking at those other wells in the area that could be causing that interference. And we may end up doing an interference test between them or some sort of an aquifer test to determine what that throw of interference is from those other users. And lastly, I would point out that there needs to be some accounting done to make sure that the people are using water within the terms of their permit or their exemption. And that's another point, another opportunity to get in there and actually make sure that people are scaled back to what they're supposed to be using. Having done all of that, then there may be regulation that occurs, and that regulation could either shut that junior user off or come up with some sort of an agreement to where a rotation agreement between the users, where they will only use it on certain days or during certain times during the evening to try to prevent that interference.
Okay. Follow up?
If I could just ask one other different question, but there's, having grown up in rural Oregon on well water, I know there's a great deal of variation in the quality of groundwater for residential consumption. Does your agency try to deal with those distinctions at all, or is water water as far as you're concerned?
Well, we do deal with those, Madam Chair, Representative, we do deal with those distinctions as they relate to wells being in distinct aquifers. For instance, you may actually be in a distinct aquifer if your water quality, that water quality may be telling us that we have a different flow system here and a distinct aquifer. So that's an important clue that we would look to. With regards to the water quality and contamination of such, we get involved with that with regards to our well construction program to try to prevent such contaminations. But natural water quality issues, those are really the purview of DEQ, and then as they relate to our rules to help us distinguish as to whether you're in a separate aquifer. This is a little windy, but we have 3 points that we look to in making a distinction of whether you're in an aquifer, in your a distinct aquifer, and one is temperature, one is water quality, and one is the water level in the well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome. Representative Klein, did you have a question?
Oh, I think he covered enough
okay.
of my mind.
Any questions from down here? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Around, we may have some other questions. And just so you know, Representative McPherson, I've asked the Department of Environmental Quality to come on Wednesday and talk about groundwater quality, because most of the discussion today is going to be, I think, more based on quantity, and mm-hmm. there is also a lot of concern about quality, and we want to make sure that the Department of Environmental Quality can come and discuss that. Next, we have a Todd Jarvis, who is from the Oregon State University Institute for Watershed, Water and Watersheds. Did I get that right?
Okay.
Thanks for coming today, Todd. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
I know you wanted a break from Corvallis anyway, right?
Yes, the term is ending.
Colleagues, I can just mention that the Water Resources Department handed out to you some items that I had asked them to provide to you. This is some background information on water resources management in Oregon. Also, some of this information is from their Ways and Means presentation that I thought would be helpful for the group. But very exciting, you have your own laminated card. So I know every time we talk about CFS in this committee, then you can whip out your card. It also has acre feet and
miners inches.
Miners inches, which one CSF is 40 miners inches. So this is if you're really bored and want to stump your friends, and don't forget to bring this. And then also the strategic plan for the department.
Madam Chair, you'll no longer be the only legislator who carries one of
right.
these in your.
When we say we're card-carrying members now, you'll know what we're saying, right? Thank you for providing that from the department. I appreciate it.
But since we talk about acre feet, CFS a lot, now you'll have your card to refer to. Thank you, Todd.
Madam Chair, Honorable Committee, my name is Todd Jarvis. I'm with the Institute for Water and Watersheds at Oregon State University. Thank you for this opportunity to visit with you today and for the opportunity to sneak away from Corvallis during the last week of school. My presentation is focusing on groundwater management, the subject of this informational committee, and I'd like to share with you some of my research with respect to Measure 37 and Oregon's groundwater. The organization of my talk was designed around this slide where I'll briefly discuss the changing nexus between groundwater science and policy, briefly discuss the disconnect between water and land use law, an overview of the geology and hydrology of the Willamette River Basin. I promise to keep it brief, even though I'm a geologist. Recognition of groundwater problems, which Mr. Woodcock has already discussed a little bit. My research on Measure 37 claims in the Willamette River Basin and this issue of exempt versus estimated use for the purposes of planning. All sciences, professions, engineering professions, legal professions, occasionally address where they stand in the past and where they're looking to the future. Hydrogeology just underwent one of these reviews in the past couple of years where we were looking at the past. Where do we have a lot of information? Where did we need to grow? And globally, we believe that we have a lot of information with respect to the hydrogeology and how to deal with groundwater situations, some of the technical studies. We have a better feel for groundwater economics institutions and how its groundwater is linked to society, and we have a very little with respect to foundation and groundwater policy and governance, and it's prescient that this committee is now considering that here in Oregon. And where we'd like to be in about 20 years is that we think that we have enough information on the hydrogeology. It's a little brave to be saying that as a hydrogeologist, but that we do need to grow with respect to establishing better groundwater institutions, and we need to ultimately expand our emphasis both financially and institutionally on groundwater policy and governance. You've heard a lot about Measure 37. I know you're wrestling with that issue, and I'm not going to bore you with the intricacies associated with Measure 37. Understand, from my perspective as a groundwater hydrologist, anything to do with land use, I look through the eyes of what is the footprint with respect to water. Most of the claims that you've already heard are floating around 7,400 today are outside of the urban growth boundaries, which would mean that if there are additional developments outside of the urban growth boundaries, they will probably have to rely on groundwater, individual water supply wells, either for small group use or individual use. Before Measure 37, county planning agencies could deal with zone change applications within a groundwater restricted area to comply with a statewide planning goal number 5, which is the conservation of natural resources. But after Measure 37, the statewide planning goal number 5 no longer applies. And that Measure 37 basically invalidates a groundwater restricted area identified by a county. And so what that ultimately leads to is that there's very little with respect to controlling additional wells being installed in areas that might be considered at risk with respect to additional groundwater development. Now, you've already heard Mr. Woodcock discuss the groundwater limited areas in the Willamette River Basin. This map here shows the outline of the Willamette River Basin, and the different colors represent both the water well density on the left as well as the geologic map on the right. Obviously, the more darker blue colored in the area indicates a higher density of water supply wells. No surprise, we see a lot of the well densities increasing in the vicinity of the urban areas. The red outlines on that left map represent the outlines of the groundwater limited areas identified by the Oregon Water Resources Department. The map on the right, this is a very generalized overview of the geology of the Willamette River Basin. And I bring your attention to the red color, which is the outline of the Columbia River basalt, which, as Mr. Woodcock previously indicated, is the aquifer of concern in the Willamette River Basin simply because of it's very productive and it also has very high quality water. The existing situation today is the U.S. Geological Survey, as well as Oregon Water Resources Department, estimates there's about 100,000 wells in the Willamette River Basin. Statewide, you heard that the wells are being installed on the order of 3,000 to 4,000 annually. Mr. Woodcock's slide showed that in the Willamette River Basin itself, it was the installation rate was on the order of about 1,300 to 1,500 over the past few years. The bulk of the groundwater limited areas were designated in 1992. The most recent additions were Victor Point, which you heard was a very high level of control, and that was added in 2001, and the Amity Hills Walnut Hill groundwater limited area was added in 2003. So what you can see is this postage stamp alignment of these groundwater limited areas every couple of years, and the outline of these is starting to show that it's pretty much along the lines of the outline of the Columbia River basalt. The groundwater limited areas are generally based on water level declines. This is a hydrograph of a well in the Clackamas County area in the Columbia River basalt. And as what you can see is the water levels have dropped about 60 feet over the past 40 years in the Willamette River Basin and the Columbia River basalt. Is that a lot? I don't know. Elsewhere in the state, the water levels declined upwards to 200 to 400 feet in comparable aquifers. Now, what I'd like to do now is to discuss my research on Measure 37 claims. When I did my research, it was back in 2005. If you recall, that was kind of a tumultuous period for Measure 37. It was being bantered about whether or not it was unconstitutional or not. So when I finished my research, this was when Marion County judge had declared it to be unconstitutional, and it was placed into the hands of the Supreme Court. At that point in time, there was somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 claims statewide. This was a great time for me to sneak in and do my research, simply because things were the Measure 37 claims were more or less static in the Willamette River Basin. And what I did was I visited each county planning office and reviewed their Measure 37 claim files. What I was searching for was some idea of how many new homes were going to be added by virtue of these claims. What I found was interesting. Each county handled the Measure 37 process very differently. Some of them didn't ask the claimants whether how many new homes they might be adding as part of their claim. So as you can see, there's a couple of question marks on this map, and that represents where the data was not necessarily complete. But a very interesting pattern started to emerge. It's at that point in time. Now, if you recall, today the Measure 37 claims are right around 7,400. So we're taking a look at a snapshot in time with respect to these Measure 37 claims. And what we're seeing is I counted that there may be upwards to 7,500 to 10,000 new wells if each home was supplied with an individual well. Now, it's possible that some of these wells could be shared between homeowners, but my experience dealing with the development of rural landscapes has been that many times these homes are not built all at the same time, so it's difficult to share wells. I was trying to figure out if my numbers were any good. And what was interesting is in 2006, the Deschutes Water Alliance did a comparable study in the Deschutes River Basin, and what they found was they were estimating that about an additional 12,000 exempt wells would be installed in the Deschutes River Basin by the year 2025. So I thought my numbers were relatively good based on that comparison. And the obvious future potential problem areas with respect to groundwater based on this analysis include Yamhill County. If you take a look at that, I counted up about 3,400 new homes or proposed homes in that area, Washington County and Marion County. Now, the assumption made there is that every claim would ultimately result in a new house being built. I think this might be representative at that point in time, simply because the number of claims has increased by a factor of three. The exempt well situation in Oregon, as you heard from Mr. Woodcock, is the domestic use are allowed to pump 15,000 gallons per day. That's about 10 gallons per minute for every minute of every day. If predicted exempt wells in the Willamette River Basin use 15,000 gallons per day, the estimated withdrawals would approach 150 million gallons per day. That's making the assumption that each well would exercise the maximum amount of water that it was permitted to use. Or that would be about twice as much water that was estimated for domestic use by Rick Bastach in his recent update of Waters in Oregon book of what she estimated to be about 76 million gallons per day. If the predicted exempt wells in the Willamette River Basin used 1,000 gallons of water per day, which is the metric used by the Deschutes Water Alliance during the course of their study, the estimated withdrawals would approach about 10 million gallons per day. To give you a comparable figure that you might be more comfortable with, is that would be about 15.5 cubic feet per second, and that would be about a 13% increase in the reported statewide domestic use of 76 million gallons per day. The groundwater policy and management challenges, I think, that are facing Oregon are that historically domestic wells were exempt because the quantity of developed water appeared to be minor or de minimis compared to the large quantities of water used for irrigation and other purposes. But the water pumped by the exempt domestic wells is no longer de minimis. Given the potential increase in reliance on exempt wells over these large areas associated with rural development, the question needs to be asked is, should exempt wells be part of the water rights equation? Another question that I pose is, what should be used as the water planning and policy metric for exempt wells, and especially in intensively exploited groundwater basins? Is it, should we be using the exempt use of 15,000 gallons per day, or should we be using some sort of estimated use? I think it's really a difficult metric for us to use, especially if you ask us to start doing planning studies. This is the list of references that I used. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Great. Thank you so much, Todd. Really appreciate you coming here today. Are there any questions for Mr. Torvis?
Yes.
Representative Burley has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this would also perhaps apply to the department as well. I've wondered about this, you know, how much do we estimate these exempt wells using? And it's interesting, studies range from basically half the allowable to the full allowable. I'm curious, if do we have any empirical evidence on that? Has that ever been done?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, what we're seeing is that I don't know if the relationship is direct, but one of the things that we see with these rural developments is that the homes are becoming larger, the square footage is becoming larger, there's beginning a larger number of bathrooms. In my experience as a consultant, I found that there was a relationship between the size of the house and the water use, that it would increase. There was no equation that we could use. But Rick Bastach, in his recent book, he came out, he made an estimate. He found that if we look at the traditional metric of water consumption, you should probably rely on a well that makes about 10 gallons per minute. With these larger homes going in, he's suggesting that maybe a better planning metric is to use a well that makes 18 gallons per minute. What that would mean with respect to average daily consumption is it almost doubles the average daily consumption. But I'm sorry, but the question that's difficult that I have found to deal with my consulting work is that if people are permitted to use a large quantity of water, they will try to use that large quantity of water, especially if the enforcement is based on neighbors reporting on other neighbors. That's something that's not considered to be too neighborly.
Does the department want to come up and respond to that as well? Are you okay?
Sure. I do want to comment on one thing. I mean, I don't spend a lot of time researching or studying this, but I'm not sure that the correlation of the size of the house square footage itself is a good one. I would submit it's more the number of teenage kids you got in the house.
That too. Did you want to respond, Doug?
Yes, Doug Woodcock with Water Resources Department. Madam Chair, as I pointed out in our discussion earlier about how we go about these groundwater investigations, when we look at an area to try to get an estimate as to what the existing uses are, we look to those areas where there are rural developments that actually have metering going on. And so we have that empirical evidence from the standpoint of rural water systems that are metered, and those individual uses are less than 1,000 gallons a day. It's generally a few hundred gallons a day for in-house use and then some ancillary outside uses.
So, Doug, can I ask you, where did the 15,000 gallons per day number come from? And I've seen the range of other states, and we're sort of in the middle of the range. It was, and since I wasn't around when that was passed into law, what metric was used for that exemption?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I can't answer that specifically. I was not here either when that was brought in. What I've been told was that ideally it was for group domestic uses. Mm-hmm. So several users would all get together for one exemption.
Okay. Any other questions for this panel?
Madam Chair, can I just follow up on this? Because now I'm even more confused about the estimates, because you've said it could be as high, and this sounded like a credible estimate of 18 gallons per minute. Is that right?
Yes, that was what was recommended by Rick Bastach in his book about water management in Oregon.
And if that is true over the course of a 24-hour day, we're talking about 25,000 gallons a day, and you're saying perhaps as little as a few hundred in a typical well. So this is a tremendous range.
I don't think one part of the Mr. Bastach's comment is that the well wouldn't necessarily be pumping 24 hours a day. That's what they were recommending to supply a house for the consumption during a regular day.
I see. So it's a different metric than the one you're referring to.
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Klein.
Thank you. On your chart, blue dots, groundwater limited areas generally based on water level declines. You mentioned, and I just want to make sure I got it right, that there are some other similar basaltic areas or aquifers in Oregon where the levels have climbed 200 to 400 feet versus a decrease of 60 feet over 40 years. Excuse me, they've increased.
No, the word was declined.
Oh,
so
oh.
Elsewhere in the state, the water levels have declined upwards to 200 to 400 feet.
And 60 feet in the Willamette.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Madam Chair, if I can respond also. There are localized areas where we have groundwater declines, and predominantly in the Columbia River basalt aquifers. So the slide that Mr. Jarvis pointed out there did show that very stately decline there, and had many tens of feet of decline. An interesting thing about that particular slide, though, is if you were to carry that on for another year or even bring it up to present, you would see that that water level in that well has almost fully regained that entire decline over the decades. That particular well is up in the Wilsonville Damish area. It's the old Damish well. And as Wilsonville moved off of groundwater and moved on to surface water, we've seen this rather large relaxation of groundwater stress in the area, and those water levels are coming back. So that particular slide does not reflect the state of groundwater declines up in that area, though there are areas where there are some declines that do need addressing.
Other questions? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It strikes me that more than the size of the house, that the size of the lot, at least one that's groomed with plantings, would be a more significant driver on water consumption. Could you confirm, either one of you, that sort of intuitive impression I have?
Madam Chair, I would comment that yes, if you have extensive landscaping, then there's a commitment made there, both by effort and finances, to make sure that that stays stately and green and colorful. Certainly, folks who dedicate their landscaping to xeriscaping or reduce that have a far less impact on the water use than their counterparts there. Indoors, it varies as to what the water uses are, but it's generally a few hundred gallons a day for the indoor uses, for the showers, for the washing, that type of thing.
Yeah, and Representative McPherson, you know, same for municipal use. Landscaping is the biggest. That's why we see a huge surge in the summer with demand, is because of the demand from watering people's lawns and their plants, and that's typically the way it is if you're on urban water supplies as well. Any other questions for this panel? Great. Representative Jensen?
Yeah, I'm just on exempt well. What's the maximum size lawn that you can be irrigating?
Madam Chair, the representative, the exemption for irrigation of non-commercial lawn and garden is 1/2 acre.
Okay. So as a agency, you can also, if you go out there and you see somebody has a 15-acre lawn that's lush, that would ring some kind of a bell. Then, is that,
Madam Chair, Representative? That's correct.
I mean,
we would look to, and often when people have that 15-acre lawn, we get phone calls on those things to let us know that somebody is perhaps exceeding the exemption that they're entitled to, and so the water minister would go.
So we're pretty. A 1/2 acre, that's lawn and garden. That doesn't include 5 acres to a pasture for your horse.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. The exemption for irrigation is up to 1/2 acre of non-commercial lawn and garden.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Thanks for coming here today.
Madam Chair.
Guilty.
Okay, next we're honored to have Commissioner Dennis Dougherty from Umatilla County, who came all the way here today as well.
Are you watering?
A lot.
Thank you, Commissioner.
I had to water in the winter. Nice.
Welcome to the Capitol.
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Dennis D. Dougherty. I am the current chairman of the Umatilla County Board of Commissioners. I'm here really to talk to you in two capacities today. We have our county interest, and I'll deal with that first. Umatilla County, as you've already heard, by the way, both Mr. Woodcock and Mr. Jarvis are intimately acquainted with our situation in Umatilla County. In Umatilla County, we have 4 of the 7 critical groundwater areas in the state of Oregon. And the 4 together encompass a huge number of acres that far exceeds the acreage involved in any of the other critical groundwater areas. We share 3 of those critical groundwater areas with Morrow County, our neighbor to the east. And the acreage involved in the total acreage involved in the 4 is roughly equal between the 2 counties. In Umatilla County, although we are not the leading ag producer because we don't have a huge nursery industry in our county, we still claim to be at or near the top among Oregon's 36 counties in terms of food production. And water, of course, is instrumental to that capacity, as is our huge farm-to-market road system. So water is something that we are very keenly interested in, and the shortage of water that we have is something that we're very keenly interested in. We are doing something that is pretty proactive. Approximately 38 months ago, we formed a critical groundwater area task force to explore the subject and to bring recommendations back to the Board of Commissioners from which we could devise a 2050 water plan that we could run with. We found during the 38 months that we can't really just talk about groundwater alone. There is a holistic interconnection with surface water that exceeds what most of us were expecting when we started. But groundwater is the focus of this oversight, so that's what we'll focus on. Also, I'm here representing a newly formed Association of Oregon Counties Water Policy Committee. The decision was made at our pre-legislative session convention to form such a committee. It was formed effective the beginning of February. We had our second meeting this morning. And the written testimony that has been handed out to you comes from that committee. This morning, the committee authorized me to be their representative, and we're requesting participation. Our main purpose in appearing today is to request participation on whatever work group that you use. I think that I can keep the commitment I made to our committee that I could be here for those work sessions. And if I don't, I would ask either our planning director, Tamara Mabbitt, or our water resources person, J.R. Cook, to attend on my behalf. Now, the county task force that I was talking about has been meeting monthly, and I would surmise that Mr. Woodcock has been to a great many of those, and I know that Mr. Jarvis has as well. In fact, we have a contract arrangement with Mr. Jarvis's institution, and he's helping us with some data synthesis and with some outreach. I don't have any particular request to make of you today, but I do want to advise you of one other matter that we're interested in. So far, you've just heard talk about the hydrology and the data. The Association of Oregon Counties and Umatilla County are both interested also in the jurisdictional matter, because in our case, counties have some authority for planning, not just land use planning, but water planning, ORS 195.025, for instance, directs that the counties would be the convening venue for bringing people within the county together for planning for all purposes, and that would include water, and that's the surmise that we're operating under with our county task force. What we don't have any place in the approximately 416 pages of Oregon statutes in the water code, so far as I know, is anything that gives us any authority or any explicit rule at all in terms of regulation, management, or enforcement. So when we do our land use planning duty, which requires us to do two things, protect the resource under Goal 5 and assure the sustainability or the carrying capacity of the resource under 11 of the 14 goals that apply to us, you know, we can only go so far with that in terms of our planning role. Since we don't really have a role under Oregon water law, we are trying very hard to understand better what the state's real intention is here and how it's going to bridge the land use responsibilities we have with the water law responsibilities that the state agency has. And we've already initiated steps to begin a dialogue with the state agency and already, in fact, had a meeting with the state agency leadership on that. But those are the kind of reasons that make Umatilla County and the Association of County interested in this subject. So I have my name and address at the back of the written testimony, and I would ask be put on your notification list of anything that would be material or germane to us. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate you coming here today and sharing this information. Are there any questions for the commissioner?
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
No question, but I would like to underline a point that Commissioner Doherty is I think ultimately making, and that is the interrelationship between ground or water use planning or water and land use. Mm-hmm. It seems to me, and it has for a number of sessions, and I've made these comments before, it seems to me foolish that we have one committee out doing a whole bunch of land use planning without any consideration of the water that they're going to have to be looking at and dealing with. And then we have another committee that has dealt with water use and water use planning that seems not to be terribly informed about the land use issues that are going on. I have tried to advocate and will continue to try to advocate that this should be one committee, one committee dealing specifically with these two issues, because I don't know how you separate water use and land use.
Thank you for sharing those comments, Representative Jensen. And I will say that we seem to have, since we have the chair of the Transportation Committee here, we have seemed to get the link between land use planning and transportation, but we have not fully, I think, explained the connection, done a good job. I'm just saying, as legislators, I think done a good job at explaining that link between land use and water, and you're absolutely right. I mean, without the water, you can't have development, and you can't
plan unless you know how much water you have. So that's part of, I think, our task here is to figure out the best way to make sure that we're using a resource wisely and planning for that. I certainly appreciate and understand the challenges the counties are in, and we do have a member of the Measure 37 Land Use Fairness Committee here. Unfortunately, the other member had to leave, and I think that they are, I know there's been discussions in that committee about this very issue, so I think your being here today is very timely, and we look forward to having you on the work group.
Thank you.
Next, I'm going to call up, in the interest of time, I'm actually going to call up Katie Fast and Jeff Stone, if they would come up together, talk about agricultural interests, or concerns, I should say. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. As you all are aware, water is the lifeblood of Oregon agriculture. 62% of harvested cropland relies on irrigation, and irrigated farms produce 77% of the total value of harvested crops. About 14% of Oregon's agriculture irrigation comes from groundwater sources. And since the majority of Oregon's surface water is fully appropriated, there has been increased interest in use of groundwater. Farm Bureau's membership is growing increasingly concerned with exempt wells' potential impact on existing water rights. And this current concern has been accelerated by the uncertainty of Measure 37 and the cumulative impact of exempt wells on existing water rights. Currently, farmers in some areas are observing the drop in aquifer levels that are below the pumping levels of their wells. They are forced to drop their wells to utilize their rights. However, this is not considered injury due to their ability to drop the well to continue to utilize their full right that's entitled. However, in areas where the aquifer is fully appropriated, new exempt uses can result in shortages to existing groundwater users. This is more of the situation that our membership is concerned about. As you've heard before from the department today, they currently have the ability to regulate exempt wells in critical groundwater areas and groundwater limited areas. However, they rarely do. And many of these areas are in high growth areas of the state. And I've attached some maps that you've also received from Water Resources today as well. This sets up situations where exempt uses continue to grow and conflicts between water users expand. Farm Bureau does not see existing legislation such as House Bill 2266 as a solution to these groundwater issues. There's some concern that current proposals will cripple water resources' ability to manage their existing duties and manage new duties put on them. However, we do believe that the state needs to improve water planning, especially at times and in areas of high growth. A system needs to develop that protects existing water right holders as Oregon grows and changes. Farm Bureau envisions this, including some increased management authority and oversight at Water Resources Department for exempt wells, along with increased water development, water reuse, and storage to meet future demands. We look forward to participating and exploring these concepts in a work group developed through this committee, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead, Jeff, and then we'll take questions.
Great. Madam Chair, I'm Jeff Stone. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I always get my plug in that we're a billion-dollar industry. We'd welcome more Umatilla nursery growers. But reminder of the importance of agriculture in the economy, agriculture has grown steadily over the past two decades and is a major contributor to the Oregon economy, with over $4 billion in sales and an economic impact of $12 billion annually. Agriculture is integral to the Oregon way of life and provides one in every 12 jobs. The chair's bill and the committee's bill, HB 2566, as proposed, is a rough cut to an issue that deserves more careful consideration. As currently drafted, the bill would require every would-be domestic groundwater user to apply for a water right under the same process now in place for higher quantity users. The resulting dramatic increase in water right applications would have a significant impact on the Water Resources Department's ability to conduct its existing work, for which it's already short-staffed. It is difficult to project the future of exempt wells on the nursery industry. However, we remain very concerned that many of these new wells could be adjacent or nearby properties owned or operated by OAN members. These new wells could lead to problems of water availability or well interference. This uncertainty is only increased by the large number of Measure 37 claims in rural lands. As you've already heard from Oregon State University, the thing that got our growers' attention was between 7,500 and 10,000 potential new wells statewide. Clearly, this number holds some concern to us. As noted, though, our members are also concerned with additional administrative burdens that any bill would place upon both Water Resources Department and groundwater appropriators. Water right holders already experience significant processing times for water rights related to matters due to a lack of staff. The bill does not contain any new funding or mechanisms by which new previously exempt applications would be processed by the department. And a significant new burden would be in existence for an understaffed agency. The OAN recognizes the potentially large impact of exempt wells on its members and the public in general. The OAN also recognizes the limitations of WRD staff and the sizable administrative burden of subjecting all new appropriations to permitting and certification requirements currently applicable to non-exempt uses. Weighing these competing interests is a difficult task. Due to these and other issues not addressed by the current bill, the OAN supports and would welcome an opportunity to participate in a work group if it was formed by this committee. Thank you for your time and attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Katie, I had a quick question for you regarding your comment about, and we had a discussion before about injury. So if there is, and maybe Doug can address this, but if somebody is, they're, you know, has to drill deeper for their well, I mean, is there any recourse about getting compensated for those costs?
Chair Dingerfelder, there currently is not. That is put on the water right user, and it's their responsibility to fully appropriate or utilize their water right, and that is part of the expense of doing that is dropping your well down so you can still utilize your water right. However, it does show that there's an increased demand on that water supply, and we're concerned about the future of those water supplies being available for agriculture, since water is what keeps us in business along with land.
Okay. All right, thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming here today. I'm actually going to ask people if they can come up together, even though I know you're not testifying together, just for the interest of time. So next we have John DeVoe with Water Watch and Amanda Rich from the Special Districts. If you can come up, and then the last panel will be Jerry Schmidt, Jim Welsh, and Harlan Levy, because I want to try to make sure and get everybody in today. So welcome.
Good afternoon.
Do you have a PowerPoint presentation?
I have two slides.
Okay. Okay. Do you want to start, Amanda, while he's loading that up? Because that way we don't have to wait.
Sure.
That'd be helpful.
I will be brief. My name is Amanda Rich, and I'm here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I also represent the Oregon Association of Water Utilities. And planning and management are an integral part. In fact, it's considered a primary function of what municipal water providers do. We don't have the choice to not use water. we have a duty to serve that is statutory, and so when the demand is there, we don't really have the choice to say, no, I'm sorry, we can't serve you. And so planning for the amount of water that we're going to need and the amount of water that's going to be available to us to meet that need is a critical part of our function and our service to the community. As you are surely aware of, demographic projections show that Oregon is going to be facing significant population growth over the next 20 to 40 years. And so we are having to plan today for the citizens that we're going to have to serve tomorrow. And those planning horizons are fairly large. Most statutory planning horizons are about 20 years, but we plan much further out than that, as you all know. And we do tons of types of planning, comprehensive water plans, including water system master plans that look at 20 years out or more at our capital improvement requirements and our financial requirements. Also, water management and conservation plans that require that we look very carefully at our water rights and how we will utilize those water rights and those sources to meet our current and future demands. Those plans have to be updated every 10 years. We have to meet conservation benchmarks and update those every 5 years. Municipalities do rely on groundwater sources as both primary and secondary sources frequently. There are, in fact, very large municipalities, Portland being one of them, that relies upon groundwater as a secondary source for emergency situations. And also many folks rely on their secondary sources in situations where surface water is being taxed due to the needs of in-stream water rights, and so you move on to your secondary sources to use those in times when you don't want to tap your surface water sources. And so given our duty to serve that I referenced earlier, it's critical that those groundwater sources are there when we need them and when we need to tap them. So water planning is not an exact science. There are so many variables that we can't control for. Among them are the effect of climate change, the effect of natural disasters, or again changing patterns of weather, the effect of patterns of use of the communities that we serve, the effect of the surface water, groundwater, hydrologic connections that you've heard talked about today, and again the availability of groundwater that you've heard talked about today. To the extent that we can tighten up the uncertainty in any of those areas, it is good for our communities and good for the future of economic development in Oregon and the stability of Oregon. So, now that said, I would like to add the caveat that you heard Jeff Stone talk about, that we are very concerned about the effect that increased regulation requirements would have on the Water Resources Department, and that's why we're very supportive of fully funding the department to the greatest extent that we can to make sure that they are able to serve those critical functions and are able to help us with the water planning that we have to do. That's the general testimony I wanted to provide today. I'd be happy to answer any questions if I could.
Okay, thank you, Amanda. Any questions for Amanda? I have a quick question about, and this is something maybe you can provide us later, the percentage as far as municipalities, the percentage that rely on groundwater as their primary water supply versus surface water.
I don't have those figures today. I wanted to get them, but I wasn't able to get them in the time frame. But I am also interested in finding out, and I will try to have them for the committee, and also if we are going to work group this issue, I'll try to have them for that.
Great. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
John?
Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is John DeVoe. I'm the Executive Director of Water Watch of Oregon. I'm here to testify a little bit about groundwater management across the state as we currently see it. Water Watch was founded in 1985. We are devoted to ensuring there's enough water in our rivers and streams to protect fish, wildlife, public uses of our waterways, and the people who depend on healthy rivers. We have members across the state who care about these issues. Groundwater is the unseen tributary. When I say that, what I'm saying is groundwater is often the source for surface flows in our rivers and streams. And therefore, any discussion about groundwater really needs to start with the state of our surface waters in Oregon. With few exceptions, Oregon's surface waters are fully and over-appropriated, meaning there is really no water left to give away at the times of year when people need it most. If you look at the statistics from the Water Resources Department, about half of the applications for new water rights in 2004, 2005 were for groundwater. If you add to that the roughly 3,800 exempt wells per year that we seem to be putting out across the state, that number goes up to about 85% of new water uses and applications being for groundwater. So clearly we are placing new and substantial burdens on the state's groundwaters, and we need to properly and carefully manage this important resource. It needs our urgent attention. Before I talk about groundwater specifically, I want to talk about how groundwater is the unseen tributary and deviate into hydrology a little bit. As the slide on the screen indicates, over time, withdrawing water from a groundwater well will eventually deplete an adjacent surface flow in a waterway, a stream or a river. In the before development scenario, A up there, you have groundwater discharging into the stream. B assumes the installation of a well, and in the early period, the water that's being withdrawn from that well comes primarily from storage in the aquifer. Scenario C is later in time, and as you continue to pump that well, what you see is the water that comes out of the well is both a reduction in storage in the aquifer, but also it's reducing the discharge of the aquifer to the adjacent stream over time. And then at a full development scenario in item D up there, what you have is a well that takes water, it reduces discharge to the stream, and it increases recharge from the stream to the aquifer. So it's really drawing primarily from the surface water source over time. This is an example of those same concepts over time from a well in the Deschutes Basin. And what you see is when the well begins to pump, all the water that comes out is primarily from storage in the aquifer. But over time, what happens is you are drawing water that would have gone to stream flow in a waterway in the Deschutes Basin. So over time, the proportion of water taken out of the well decreases as a function of storage in the aquifer and increases as a function of taking water from the adjacent surface water body. And why is this important? Well, for the reasons I stated, we've already over-allocated most of our streams in the state, and we have significant demands on those stream flows already. Obviously, the timing of impact on stream flows and surface water resources can be localized, and it depends on a number of circumstances. But these general hydrological points are really not in dispute. However, despite the settled nature of hydrology and these general concepts, Oregon has, with limited exceptions, continued to issue permanent water rights for groundwater across the state in the face of a lack of data in many basins in the state. And so we have four basic suggestions for how to improve groundwater management in Oregon. The first is that Oregon needs comprehensive statewide assessments of groundwater supplies, what the sustainable yields are from our aquifers, and the interactions between surface and groundwater. And to date, it's our understanding that the Water Resources Department has embarked upon or completed groundwater studies in the Deschutes Basin, the Upper Klamath Basin, the Lost River Basin, parts of the Willamette Basin, and the South Coast and Rogue Basins. A couple of these studies are complete, some of them are nearing completion, and some of them are simply in their infancy. In the Oregon State of Environment Report 2000, I think it was from the Oregon Progress Board, the Water Resources Department estimated it could take decades to complete these regional groundwater studies for the entire state. But that same report also concluded that these comprehensive assessments are a key need to meet successfully the state's water challenges and to engage in effective water planning for the state. So we would urge members of this committee to take necessary and appropriate steps to retain and increase the department's budget and capacity to undertake and complete these sorts of critical studies for the rest of the state. It's an urgent need, and it's my understanding is groundwater investigations are not currently within the governor's 2007-2009 budget for water resources. So we need to get that capacity into the budget. The second recommendation we have is that Oregon should protect the state's scenic waterways from diminishment due to groundwater development. Under Oregon law, the highest and best use of waters within the so-called Oregon scenic waterways are recreation, fish, and wildlife uses. And Oregon law prohibits diminishment of protected scenic waterway flows. As an example of where we're falling short, in the Deschutes Basin, there was an amendment in 1995. I don't really need to go into the details, but there have been almost 200 water rights for groundwater issued in the Deschutes for almost 200 cubic feet per second of groundwater between the 1995 amendment to the Scenic Waterway Act and the requirement that people mitigate for new groundwater rights in the Deschutes Basin. There's been no regulation of these water rights. There's been no requirement that these groundwater users mitigate for the impacts they are having on stream flows in the Deschutes. And yet the one study we have for the basin, the USGS Water Resources Department study, indicates that any use of groundwater within the Deschutes Basin study area has an impact on protected Scenic Waterway Act stream flows. So we need to get our house in order there. 12 years after those amendments, we still only have two basins, the Deschutes and the Grand Ronde, where the Water Resources Department has studied the impact between Scenic Waterway Act flows and groundwater development. So we would urge that the department act to take care of the situation in the Deschutes and also increase its understanding across the state. The third recommendation is that Oregon should take a more conservative approach to issuing new permanent groundwater rights in light of the existing data gaps across the state. We currently have what's known as the Division 9 review for new applications. This review does not apply to exempt uses. And the Division 9 review, basically what it does is it says if a proposed use is within a quarter mile of a surface water body, then the department will evaluate the proposed use as an application for surface water, the assumption being that that well would pull water from the adjacent surface water body. The Division 9 rules, this is sort of this quarter mile distance from surface water bodies doesn't jibe with hydrogeologic reality in basins across the state. And so you can have a situation like we do in the Deschutes where it's been determined that any well in the basin will affect stream flows, and yet we're only evaluating new groundwater uses within a quarter mile of surface water bodies for these Division 9 impacts. And then there are other instances under those rules where there's further evaluation. But the combination of Division 9's inadequacy and the lack of studies across the state would counsel that we go slow when issuing new groundwater rights that are permanent in the face of a lack of data on the interaction between surface and groundwater across the state. We would suggest that there be time limitations on new groundwater rights issued until we have further data, or a reopener clause in new water rights that are issued for groundwater to account for later uncovered data that indicates there could be interaction or a problem with other water users. And then the fourth recommendation we have is to deal with the exempt well issue across Oregon by closing the loophole for exempt wells. You've heard testimony from other folks today, and I won't duplicate that, about the number of wells. But I was struck by what seemed to be we don't have a handle on how much these wells are actually taking out of aquifers across the state at any one time. And I would suggest to the panel that once these wells are established, whether they're using 10 gallons or 1,000 gallons or 15,000 gallons as they are permitted, it's not entirely relevant because the water has in effect been given away at that point and there is an entitlement to use it. So we need to be careful in granting these entitlements to use and consider that as we go forward. Currently, the state does not account for the cumulative effect of the approximately 230,000 exempt wells around the state. And these wells exacerbate existing surface water problems in Oregon, We've been made aware of situations down on the Chetco River, for example, with its prize run of fall Chinook, where exempt wells are being installed literally next to the bank of the river. And those wells are essentially drawing from stream flows in that river. The Chetco is pretty much closed to further surface water appropriation. So this is a problem. In the Deschutes Basin, for example, new groundwater rights must mitigate for their effects on stream flows, but exempt wells do not have to. And you saw the data from the Deschutes Water Alliance, the DRC, that suggests there will be up to 32,000 of these wells in the basin by 2025. Exempt wells also exacerbate existing groundwater problems. I think it was clear, but I want to reemphasize that exempt wells are not prohibited in the vast majority of Oregon's groundwater limited or critical groundwater areas, or even areas where groundwater has been withdrawn for further use.
Okay, John, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up.
Yep.
Thanks.
In 1955, the House Water Committee recognized the inadequacy of current practices in Oregon, and the response was to adopt, the legislature adopted the first groundwater code in the West. But here, after five decades, we still lack some pretty basic data about this important resource. So we would suggest that until relevant studies are completed, Oregon should take active steps to manage the resource conservatively, close the exempt well loophole, and prevent further interference with surface waters of the state. And we look forward to working on the work group.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Representative Smith?
Thank you. Sir, I appreciate your testimony. It was rationally presented. Your four recommendations primarily restricted water use. I'm trying to reconcile with earlier testimony we heard that the state's population is going to significantly grow. Can you help this panel reconcile the restriction on water use with the demand that we see coming for food and for shelter?
Yeah, I'll try and do that. Chair Dingfelder, Representative Smith. If you look at the data around the state and in instances across the West right now, what you see is a decoupling of the curve that shows a rising gross domestic product, a rising production, or rising population, and actual water use. You can look at a place like the city of Seattle, which has grown by over 400,000 residents between the mid-70s and now, but it actually uses less water than it used in 1964. The city of Portland is showing some similar trends, as is Corvallis and other cities. So population alone is really not the driver of water use that it has been presumed to be. Now, obviously, there are isolated situations that need to be dealt with. Agricultural use, I have less to offer you on that, but I can tell you that in the Columbia Basin up in Washington, as a result of this new storage bill they have, they've done some studies up there, and some groups have also done some studies, and what they found, I believe, is that demand for ag water in Washington, and at least in the Columbia Basin, is relatively flat, even though we've seen increasing production of crops. And I would point you to the USGS reports that come out every 5 years. I believe between 1990 and 2000, demand dropped across Oregon in industrial, irrigation, and municipal public use sectors, despite adding over 300,000 acres of cropland during that period. So I think anything we do with water, we can do with less water. And we have to be efficient and we have to conserve.
Representative Smith, just to follow up to that, unfortunately you weren't with us on Friday when we did the field trip, but part of the field trip was we visited the Central Oregon Irrigation District, and we did see the efforts that they're taking to conserve and try to restore flows. And one of the things that they have done and been very aggressive in Central Oregon is actually the piping. Their canals, they have saved 30% of their water use through piping, and other measures also. The irrigation districts have been upgrading their irrigation technologies to conserve water. So actually, water conservation is, in essence, and in this case, is a new water supply. And I know the Swale Irrigation District, I think they mentioned, is also in the process right now of piping and will save, I think, 30 to 40% of what they're getting now from evaporation and leakage.
If I can follow up.
again, I think your presentation was very logical, and I do appreciate that. I'm still trying to reconcile all the many other uses of water. And for example, this body here just a few weeks ago stated that they thought biofuels was a good alternative for the state of Oregon. Mm-hmm. And I think each of us voted in the affirmative to that. The facilities that are going to be operating and creating biofuels take billions, not millions, but billions of gallons of water. And so I'm trying to, again, reconcile the needs that we as human beings have with these restrictions. And I think perhaps maybe all of my concerns could have been alleviated if I went to Bend on Friday. But I think this committee ought to be looking at and hearing from folks such as yourself, not the recommendations on how to restrict water use, but we ought to be hearing from folks such as yourself and from the cattlemen and from everyone else on ways to better use that water. And maybe I'm just in the wrong circle, or maybe I'm not listening, and I'm willing to accept that criticism. But to me, it's my belief that water use is a reality. Where I come from in Northeast Oregon, where on that map earlier it showed it as a critical groundwater area, we're placing restrictions on the availability of water. We're reducing the ability to take water out of the Columbia River. And yet at the same time, this body is hypocritically saying, we want you to produce commodities and services that require that water. And at some point in time, I think there needs to be a reconciliation, and I'd hope Water Watch would take a lead in helping us define that reconciliation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. We welcome that.
Representative Jensen.
Hi, Representative Smith, covered that. I'll pass.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Okay, our last panel is, it's not really panel, but I'll call up the last three folks to present. We have Jerry Schmidt from the Oregon Groundwater Association, Jim Welsh from the Oregon Cattlemen Association, Harlan Levy. I should know that. I've been saying the name for years. Yeah. Representative Burley is swirling Snoopy over here.
Is that him?
Yeah, every time I brush it with a piece of paper.
Yes.
Sorry, folks.
Thank you, gentlemen. Jerry, why don't you go ahead and get started?
Okay. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Jerry Schmidt. I'm here today to represent the Oregon Groundwater Association. That is the consulting hydrogeologists, well constructors, pump installers, water treatment people, basically anybody dealing with groundwater. I have a handout that I'm giving you, and I don't know, maybe it's the time of day or whatever, however it's starting out, is the actual front page is the obituary out of Sunday Oregonian. But one of my drillers passed away, and I thought it was appropriate that he would have loved to have been here and chatted with you, and I thought, well, I'll include that since it was a full page article. He was a very unique individual. He loved to testify here at the legislature. He was down here many times. One of my abilities to deal with the groundwater issue is that I've made many friends over the years, people that have a vast amount of knowledge more than mine, and I'm able to call on those different resources. He was an absolute great resource on a lot of groundwater issues. The rest of the documents that I handed out were from another friend who actually is the deputy chief, or actually was the deputy chief of the groundwater section for USGS. I included some of these graphs for you guys to just look over later so that you can kind of see proportionally how some of these issues lined up that you've heard testimony about today. The graph there shows you about how total water use, how it lines out, how much a public supply uses, how much a domestic use uses, how much an irrigation uses. Going down through some of these tables, I included the surface water withdrawals, and you can look under Oregon. You can probably answer your question, Representative Dingfelder, by looking down there. Public supply under Oregon, it uses 447 million gallons per day of water. Then you look on the next page, which is the groundwater. Mm-hmm. You see how much is used for a public supply. It's 118 million gallons per day. Then there's a other item there next to it. It says domestic. That's the self-supplied domestic. That would be like wells for individual mm-hmm. pieces of property. I went through and just gave you clips out of very large circulars with the USGS that kind of gives you some background information. If you want to look at, if you're bored at night and can't sleep, you can always go to the internet and look up USGS, find a wealth of information. They are a very good scientific organization. They have a lot of information. I went further on. You'll see a map in there that kind of shows you consumptive use and renewable water supply by water resource region. What that actually points out is that how close are we to reaching our maximum limits? You'll see the Pacific Northwest is rather blessed at the fact that we haven't reached our limit by any means. We have lots of abilities to move on from here. I guess in summary, in testimony before your committee this morning, Representative Jim Fogler in the Joint Ways and Means Committee, there was some discussion about well networks and how they work and how you groundwater is a little different than surface water. We put in stream gauges and we try to figure out what goes on in wells. What we try to do is look at water levels, and we're trying to look to see if they're stabilizing, if they're declining. One of the great abilities of the Water Resources Department's well network is the fact that they have a network in place that was been established in the early 60s. So we have 40 and 50 years of water level information in some of their well network. And we strongly encourage you guys to look at that and see if, in fact, that network is declining. If it is, could you bolster some money into that thing so that you can actually get some more information? Because when they use these computer models, the computer models are only as good as the information fed into it, and they need a cross-check. And one of the cross-checks is to use these water level graphs, hydrographs, over a long period of time, and they can double-check to see if their assumptions are correct. And if, in fact, you're getting a flat line on your hydrograph and your other data is showing something different, it can mean that you may need to go back and change some of your parameters to take another look at what's actually happening in the aquifer. So it's valuable information. It's very good information. And one of the nice things about talking last is you've heard everything you want to hear. So with that, I'll pass it on to my co-worker here, President Harden.
Before you do that, since you represent both the well drillers and hydrogeologists, if you could, for I don't think we've heard in this committee about you know, for the well drillers, you have, maybe you can just describe how somebody comes to, you know, one of your clients, mm-hmm. well driller, wants a domestic well. Can you just quickly walk the committee through what they have to do with the Water Resources Department now as far as getting a start card and all that? Because I think it's important for the committee to understand the current process that an exempt user would have to go through.
And you want me to speak in reference to an exempt user?
Well, you can maybe do both.
They're both relatively the same. The difference is that one of them will have to interrupt the process by going to the department and actually securing the department's permission to take it to the next step. But most folks, what they will do, and realize that some of my folks will actually contact a hydrogeologist first, and they will do an investigation to find out what type of water is available. Exempt users historically don't do that because it costs a lot of money, and hydrogeologists are not cheap, so they don't historically go to a hydrogeologist and look for water. What they ordinarily will do is contact a well driller. The well driller will then talk to his client. Most of the drillers are fairly familiar with the areas. There are areas that you have some fairly low-yielding aquifers where your yields in your well are substantially lower than other areas. For instance, some areas you might be getting 100, 200 gallons a minute without a problem. Other areas you might get 3 to 4 gallons a minute. The drillers will help inform the person who's going after water what the likelihood is that he'll get water, and realize that the geology will change upon the piece of property that you're drilling on. So there's no assurances that you drill one well that you're going to get water. You may move over 50 feet and you'll get water. It's just the nature of geology. Some of the discussion in your committee this morning was, what about the depths of wells? Well, there are some areas, that's irregardless of how much water you're using, but there are some areas you're going to have to go deep for water because that's where it is. Peace Mountain was used this morning. Historically, water there is found no closer to the surface than 900 feet. So it's hard because that's where you start. It's not because the aquifer is driven to that level. That's where it is to begin with. So you contact your driller. The driller comes out. They have interaction with the client. The client says, yes, go ahead. Normally what they do then, of course, is to take a look at the site, make sure that setbacks are met, so the septic tank and the surrounding property lines, that they can drill the well wherever the client is suggesting. At that point, they will contact the department and take out a start card, and that start card gives them permission then to start the construction of the well. The department has a group of what they call well inspectors that will come out on site. They routinely will monitor construction of wells. They probably hit about 20% of all wells constructed. Am I close? 20% or so get actual inspections. Nobody knows for sure whether the inspector shows that day or not. So, again, it's hopefully to keep the system straight and everybody's on a fair and level playing field. The assurances are to make sure that the construction is protecting the resource and that that we're not opening it up for contamination or any kind of improper construction. And after that, the well is then available for use. Historically, will take some time before the pump's set, which is usually another operation, and then ultimately hooked up to the home. We had some comments earlier about the 15,000 gallons per day. I was around at that time. God knows I'm that old. But it was a group domestic issue, and I had worked for the health division at that time. I was reviewing plans for community water systems. Some of the information that we were discussing at the time was, how do we work on these group domestic type issues? I had a number of clients in my professional life that needed a group domestic in order to qualify because they were close to a scenic waterway and they couldn't get a permit, but they could get a group domestic permit. So there's 15 to 20 homes on one well. In fact, I have one up in Mount Hood area that has 32 on one well and still meet the 15,000 gallons per day, and I know they do because they meter. So I do know that that's the background.
Well, thank you for that explanation. I appreciate it, and I'm glad that you're around so you can explain to us that that was actually the intent of the 15,000.
Well, I hope I'm not around too much longer.
If you'll be around to see that, Jake.
Maybe.
Carlin.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. We have over 18,000 members around the great state of Oregon, and just about every community, every jurisdiction out there, you will find my members. Anyway, with respect to groundwater, our big concern, obviously, is the exemption for domestic use. Wells that are used for rural homeowners for their drinking water, for taking showers, for flushing toilets, for washing their clothes, etc. This exemption is in statute. It's codified at ORS 537.545, where it has been codified since Oregon went ahead and codified its groundwater law back in 1955. So this is a very old exemption, and we hope to keep it that way. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the public policy reasons for exempting domestic wells. I think first and most importantly is the fact that the amount of water that actually gets withdrawn is very negligible. You've got in front of you the USGS report from 2000 that shows that domestic wells account for less than 1% of the groundwater that actually gets used in Oregon. And in addition to that, nearly 90% of the water that gets pumped out of the aquifer ends up going right back into it. Second, I wanted to talk a little bit about the significant time and expense that homeowners would incur should this exemption be lost. Many of these folks have had to go through long, extensive land use approvals to obtain permits to build a house. This would just add additional layers and additional time and additional expense to them, and we would hope that the legislature does not move in that direction. Third, you've got the permitting and the workload issue with the department. You've heard a little bit about that already. I'm not going to be redundant, but suffice it to say that this would be a tremendous amount of additional work for the Water Resources Department to go after and regulate these exempt wells. I also wanted to talk a little bit about the authority the Water Resources Commission already has to regulate exempt wells, and I've listed the statutory citation for you. It's ORS 537.730, and that statute lists the numerous circumstances that the Commission already has by which they could go ahead and regulate exempt wells, and I wanted to read those into the record for you because there is a lot of authority there. First of all, if the groundwater levels in the area are declining. Second, if there is a pattern of substantial interference between wells. Third, if there is a pattern of interference or potential interference between wells and the production of geothermal resources. Fourth, if there is a pattern of substantial interference between wells and surface water. Five, if the available groundwater is being or is about to be overdrawn. Six, if the purity of the groundwater has been or reasonably may be expected to become polluted. Or seven, if the groundwater temperatures are expected to be or being or have been substantially altered. So as you can see, there is already significant authority in the statute for the Water Resources Commission to go in there and regulate these exempt uses, and we would submit to you that that statutory authority is sufficient to protect the resource. In conclusion, we support the existing statutory regime. We think it's fair. We think it does the job at both protecting the resource for the state as well as protecting property owners and their rights to dig wells. We hope that the legislature does not see fit to go out and modify the existing exemption. We think that would only serve to add to some of the frustrations that you've seen manifested recently with rural landowners. We would be happy to participate in a work group should the chair decide to appoint one. And with that, I would conclude my testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Harlan. I think we'll go on to Jim and then see if there's any questions for the panel.
Chair Dingfelder and committee members, I'm Jim Welsh representing Oregon Cattlemen's Association. The Cattlemen's Association supports Oregon's prior appropriation doctrine for water use. We have not been supportive of House Bill 2564 or 2566. We believe domestic wells for home use and livestock should be exempt from the water right permit process due to the limited use of the groundwater and because it's been agreed upon in statute. Water right use under exemption goes with the land. It should stay that way to protect land use as usable and valuable. Water Resource Department has the statutory authority to address all the water problems of the state. We've said and heard that before. Removing the domestic well exemption would needlessly cost real home property owners money and time for a limited amount of water use. Also, removing the domestic well exemption would needlessly cost the Water Resource Department the expense of the water right process for approval or denial of the right. And we know the department does not have the financial resources today to address House Bill 2566. Addressing groundwater problems should be a problem area to problem area, basin to basin approach by the Water Resource Department. We realize there are problem areas, groundwater problem areas, but they do have the tools today to address that. Before removing exemption, there should be a complete description of the problem you are addressing, because we don't think there is within this bill, and we ask, what problem are we addressing? We believe when we address these problems, there should certainly be comprehensive research and analysis to support any possible solutions that will be brought up by this body. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. Any questions from the panel? Representative Cannon.
Thank you. Madam Chair. Perhaps a clarification from Mr. Levy. According to the handout that we received from Mr. Schmidt, domestic use of groundwater withdrawals would appear to be about 7% of total groundwater. which is a significant discrepancy from the 1%, less than 1% that you cite. And I don't know if you have his handout in front of you, but it's Table 4 from USGS, year 2000, and it suggests that that domestic category, which as I understand it is the wells.
Go ahead, Chair.
16.3.
Representative Cannon, Mr. Chair, I could answer that.
Go ahead.
One of those figures, you're correct, if you're comparing to groundwater, total groundwater use to the amount used by domestic uses, it would be close to 6%. If you take the total water use, however, it's less than 1%. So it depends on if you're talking about total water, that includes surface and groundwater, it'll be less than 1%. If you're taking the statistic from groundwater only, you're correct, it's around 6%.
And just to clarify, I was taking Mr. Levy's statement that domestic wells account for less than 1% of the groundwater use in Oregon.
Okay.
My understanding is that would in fact be 7%.
Yeah, 6.89 or whatever it would be.
Thanks.
Thank you for that clarification. Any other questions? Representative Byer.
Well, under the second presentation that we had, a question was raised in my mind, and you brought it up, Harlan, in your testimony about doing something could subject the state to liability under Measure 37 or constitutional takings law. Would you kind of touch on that a minute?
Of course. Chair Dingfelder, Representative Byer, there is case law out there that indicates that water rights are property rights and that they are constitutionally protected property rights. And, you know, in Oregon we have Measure 37, which is a statutory provision, but we do have constitutional provisions in our Constitution with respect to protection of property rights and requiring compensation for those to be paid. And then, of course, the federal Constitution also has similar provisions in the Fifth Amendment. So we are concerned that if the legislature were to do something, especially with respect to existing exempt uses, to wells that are already in the ground, that have been in the ground for years, and then were to create new regulatory restrictions on those wells, that could trigger some liability. And I just wanted to point that issue out for the committee.
Okay, Representative Gurley had a follow up?
Yeah, I'm done.
Okay, thank you. Did you have a question for this panel, or you want me to bring the Water Resources Department?
Well, actually,
back
it might be, I'd probably like to ask the department to come back up to answer this.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Okay.
And just before, because I know everybody will rush out before we close this, just a reminder that we will be convening a work group. Representative Gurley has volunteered to head that up. And if you're interested, please come and talk to Kat. This is, you know, as the vice chair, this is part of the job. Please talk to Kat by noon tomorrow if you're interested, and we will certainly try to accommodate everybody that we can while trying to also make it a useful work group. So please let Kat know if you're interested. I also think, did you have a sign-up sheet?
Yeah.
But I'd like to have the department to come back up because we have another question here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In Harlan's testimony, he points out that the commission has the authority to designate groundwater and regulate exempt wells. And in Mr. DeVoe's testimony, he, although he didn't mention the fact that they have the authority, I think it's probably safe to, you'd probably agree with the fact that they do have the authority. My question is, why, if the commission has this authority, if this is such a big issue, why haven't they regulated these things if they've got the authority to do so? Or why haven't they dealt with this issue? At the risk of asking you to speak for your commission.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, that could be addressed in a couple of manners, so I want to be clear on what your question is. When you say address that issue, what specifically is the problem you're identifying here?
The regulation of exempt wells.
Okay.
And if I may, Mr. DeVoe points out in his written testimony, he says, of the state's 14 groundwater limited areas, none restrict exempt well use. Of the two where water has been withdrawn from further appropriation, only one restricts exempt well use. So why, what's the criteria? How does the commission address that in these areas?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Burley, the exempt use allowance in the groundwater restricted areas was approached from the position that the exempt uses were a very small use relative to the permitted uses that were going on, and if they continued to go on would further exacerbate the problem. So the allowance was continued there for the exempt uses. Now, since then, we've had a few of these groundwater restricted areas have come up. Local governments, local residents have raised the issue of should we still allow exempt uses, and that's certainly a discussion that we could have. Those restricted areas could be amended. As far as the regulation of exempt uses goes, we do have the authority to regulate exempt uses, and we have done so, where we actually go in and work with locals and identify, in the procedure I pointed out earlier, where we identify where the interference is actually coming from, what is the specific cause of that interference, and then regulation for the senior user has resulted in a cutback of the juniors. That authority exists, and we have exercised that. It's not something that happens very often. It's not a pleasant thing to go do, shut people off, actually shut off their household use. And often what has happened in this scenario is there's a recognition that really it's some sort of a rotation, or people will get off one system and they'll join up with another group that doesn't have that same issue there, so they're still provided by some water. Debbie, anything you care to add?
We're going to have to end in about 30 seconds here.
Madam Chair, Representative, the short answer is that at the time our commission designated those areas, they did give some thought to whether to restrictively classify or limit exempt uses. And at that time, based on what you heard from Doug, decided that it was that restricting other uses really was the best way to kind of limit further impacts to the groundwater supply. But that's not to say that as we gather additional information on the resource in those areas, the commission can go back in and adjust the rules based on what we're learning and may choose to even further restrict things like exempt uses based on that additional information.
Okay. Thank you very much. With that, we will close the informational hearing and on groundwater management, and we'll see you all on Wednesday.
Thank you.